Welcome to the Agile Wire, where professional Scrum trainers Jeff Bubles and Jeff Molesky discuss Agile topics. Now, here are your hosts, Jeff Bubles and Jeff Molesky.
And we are recording. All right, Mr. Bubles, kick us off, man.
All right, we have a special episode of the Agile Wire today. We've got Vasco on, Vasco Duarte. He's got the podcast. It's the number one Agile podcast out there, the Scrum Master Toolbox, I think, right? At least, yes. Okay, get the thumbs up here.
.org, indeed.
Yep. And so we're going to be diving in some deep topics. Vasco, I really enjoy Vasco's points of view when he's interviewing people, but we were thinking, you know, it'd be really great if we could get Vasco to expand on some of his maybe controversial topics that he has or some views and just dive into it and learn more about why he thinks what he thinks and how he coaches teams and dive into that pretty deep. So that's our goal today. So Vasco, let's start with, you know what, we talked about a number of things before we got started, and you said, I kind of want to dive in this one first, even though we talked about it last, product ownership. You said you had a very controversial view on the role of the product owner. And so I'd like to just dive into it. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So there's a number of things that I think are controversial, in my opinions, about the product owner role. I would like to start with something that was kind of a deep insight for me as I started to sell my own products, which I do through my own company and branded also as part of the ScrumMasterToolbox.org product set. And I started to understand that actually the product owner role in Scrum, as described in Scrum, is just a bureaucratic nightmare. Let's just review the basic stuff, right? So first of all, product owners are supposed to have a product backlog. I have started famously the no backlogs hashtag on Twitter. I wasn't alone. There were other people talking about it. So don't just accuse me. And the reason for that, was simple, is that I discovered through my own experience that backlogs detract from the opportunity for success of the product owner. So these days, what I like to do as a product owner in my own products is I define an audience, a set of problems that that audience faces, and then I validate that, right?
Okay.
And I validate that very quickly. Yeah, it might be a blog post or a couple of tweets or interviews on the podcast. There's many ways to do that. But I do not define the work as tasks. I don't write user stories. I say, for example, I created the Coach Your Product Owner course. And what I did is that I first asked people, what's your main struggle with the product owner role right now? Right? That was a task. But my goal, what I was looking for, is the top list of problems, of which I used to write a blog post and get feedback on that. So as a product owner, what I'm focusing on is customer interaction to generate insights, not backlog management. And when the team comes and say, hey, I need to, you know, you need to tell us what to do and you need to write the acceptance criteria, what I tell, and that's what I wrote and talk about in the e-course as well, is that no. I tell you what the goal is. You're the technical experts, right? You have to tell me how software can do this, right? Of course, that includes designers and testers and coders. It's not just the programmers who are involved in this, right? So we need to think about user experience and all of that. And sometimes we need to involve legal. Legal needs to come into the room and write the acceptance criteria with us. It's not the product owner that does this. So the product owner for me is a facilitator role. It is not a bureaucratic nightmare, document-driven, details-oriented role that very often gets propagated as the standard role for Scrum Masters, Scrum. But, you know, if we go back to the original idea, you remember, I'm sure you guys are old enough, even though you're not as old as I am, you remember the single ringable neck idea,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yep.
When Sutherland and Schwaber were talking about the product owner, they were actually talking about it as an entrepreneurial role, as somebody who owns not the feature set of the product, but the success of the business of the product. And that's what people kind of forgot about it. I say this to people, I don't want anyone who's very good at managing product backlogs, because I can get anyone else for a very cheap price to do that for me. I want someone who understands the business, who can talk to customers, who can generate insights, and also who's comfortable enough to delegate some of the bureaucratic work that is still needed to the team. with the help of the Scrum Master.
My views are very similar to yours, actually, Vasco. I didn't know where we were going to go with this. So I always tell product owners, you're the CEO of this product. So you own this product. Now, if you're the CEO, should you be involved with low-level things? So I've got this new talk that I do, taking something from Uncle Bob that's very technical with the dependency inversion principle. So a high-level thing shouldn't be dependent on a low-level thing. Like, we don't want Jeff Bezos going to Amazon Distribution Center to say, this is how you need to package these packages to get them out in 2 days. We want him to say, here's a shared goal. Here's what I need you to achieve. And these are the metrics to measure that. Here's what we say is success. Now you figure out how to achieve that. And so that's really what we're looking for a product owner to do. So I really like product owners to be thinking more outcomes instead of outputs, which is exactly what you were talking about, which I am, that's pretty cool that we're aligned on that. And just say, this is the problem I need to solve. What hypothesis do we have? And maybe that hypothesis is a product backlog item underneath, and there's a problem listed inside of that. And then we try one, and if we solve it, we're great. Maybe we have a bunch of hypotheses, and then we just cancel a bunch of them if we've actually solved it with the first hypothesis, or maybe we keep going depending on how we validate value delivery. I really like that. Jeff, what are your thoughts?
When you were talking through that and you said something to the effect of, I don't want just a backlog manager, I thought immediately of organizations and how they view Scrum Masters, which is they just want the Jira tool expert, like we need somebody to update the tasks. Like, no, that's a secretary for the team that you're looking to hire, not a Scrum Master. And I think about that the same way with how you articulate the product, or, they're just this bureaucratic nightmare. But what I wanted to ask you too, because I think I have an idea of this, is, and I think you're right, Vasco. I think that's so common with product owners, is like, they just manage a backlog. That's their job. But how did we get to that path, right? When you said Jeff and Ken had this entrepreneurial mindset, this is what they envisioned. How did we go from that to bureaucratic backlog manager over the course of 20 years?
The answer to that is rather easy. It's the same reason we now consider SAFe as agile, right? And let's not forget, let's review history here a little bit. The people behind SAFe, not all, but many, are the same behind Rational Unified Process. So
yep.
First of all, let's not be surprised that it became a behemoth, because that's what it would be. That's what they have done in the past. And, you know, history tends to repeat itself, and you usually do the same thing several times in your lifetime, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason is that people want process. Like, I used to work in Germany, love Germany, one of my favorite countries in the world, would move there if I could right now. But I mean, they like process, right? So as soon as Agile started to get to Germany, you started to have a big push towards process. And in the US, in some areas of the US, it's the same. And of course, some areas of France, and especially France, but also Italy, it's the same. So process has an important role to play for sure. But Agile started to be born, you know, back in the 90s, in late last century. It started to be born as a rebellion against process, right? That's why they were called the lightweight methodologists, all those guys that met in Snowbird, lightweight methodologists. And we're starting to go away from that. And so is Scrum, to be honest, right? Scrum has grown over time. It's one of the process frameworks that has kept the least changes over time. It has evolved the least in terms of growing in number of, you know, requirements, whatever. But it's still growing. So that's something we should consider. And that's why I very often say that I've learned more from working with CEOs and entrepreneurs in the last 10 years than I did in the first 10 years of Agile. Now, that's not to say that what I learned before was not needed. It was a very important part of my growth, right? Just like Lean, the study I did of Lean and attempting to put those practices into place was a very important part of my personal growth. But I learned a lot about Agile from entrepreneurs and from CEOs. And the reason is simple. They don't have the luxury to hide behind process. And that's what I tell my Scrum Masters in my podcast every day, is that we need to improve the lives of our teams, period. We don't need to implement process. And that's why my podcast is called Toolbox, by the way, because I don't believe that you can only use a certain number of tools. I believe we all have a huge toolbox into which we put tools, and every now and then we go there and we pick the right tool for the problem we need to solve. And that's what I try to help Scrum Masters with, to find the right tool for the job at the right time. That's why the podcast is short. It has an inspiring format of coming up with, you know, actionable takeaways. But I think that we have to be aware. We have to always be careful that the temptation in companies adopting Agile will be to add process. And of course, that happened to product owners as well, right? We added more process to product owners. As we hired more product owners, we needed to scale up their skills very fast. So what do? We standardize the training. We give them all the training. And I know you guys train product owners. I hope you're giving them a lot more than what the book says, because they need it. I train product owners as well, but I will never give a standard certification to my product owners because I don't believe that's enough. I don't even believe that's enough to get started, right? So yeah. I want to give the product owners that I train and the Scrum Masters that I talk to every day the ability to understand that their role is to make an impact. It is not to follow a process.
I like that. So would you say that there's no such thing as best practices in the Agile space?
No, that's why I call the podcast toolbox. There's a bunch of good practices out there that, depending on the context and the time of the year and the phase of the moon, might or might not work. It's incumbent upon us to find out what works at that time and not blame Scrum or even SAFe, which has a lot of good stuff in it, for it not working for us. We are responsible for it.
That's why I liked your podcast as a toolbox, because I really like that term as a toolbox. I always tell teams that there's emerging practices and you need to pull different practices at different times, depending on the situation, and context matters. And what you need today is not what you'll need tomorrow. And you're not going to need what team B or C or D over there needs. You're going to need different things at different times. So you need to have a bunch of things in your back pocket or tools to pull out and know when to use them, when not to use them. So I really love that.
That was interesting where you went with that, Vasco, because I was along the same lines with what I was originally thinking in there, but I thought it was the tools that kind of screwed us all up, because when you were originally talking, you were saying, like, you know, your backlog, why does it need to be user stories? Why does it need to be in this structure that you're talking about? Why, you know, then it's just the bureaucratic nightmare. But like, Scrum doesn't say it needs to be in Jira in a user story format. It just says you need to have a place that somebody can go to get these ideas. But how you do that, and that's immediately where you went with, oh, well, they just decided to make it a process. And I was thinking tools. So awesome, right in the same area. But then I was thinking, like, well, how do you pull this back out of that? And I always go back to that spine model, right? Like, if we're starting up here with values at the top, and then we're talking about principles underneath there, but then somewhere along the lines, we went too far down. We went down into processes and tools to help us solve these problems. And we need to bring ourselves back up. And that frees us of the tools and the processes discussion and brings us back up to the level of, why are we doing these things and what are we really after? Or here at this top level is our goal. And we fell into the trap of, this is how we've been solving this problem for so long. How can we take a step back, revisit our goals, and then see if there's other ways to achieve them?
Yeah, I'd like to take that even further and say that one word that you said that for me has become paramount and perhaps the key catalyst for improvement is that we need to have very clear goals. What is it that we want to achieve? Not do, but achieve. And the reason for that is I very often see, especially in the Agile community, people talking about principles, right? You know, we talk about process, but process is not enough. You need to know the principles behind it. No, you don't need to know the principles. You need to be able to learn quickly, and you need to have a very clear goal, because principles won't help you. Principles are just going to be translated into more process. That's what principles are there. They are the distilling of the ideas behind the process. But we don't want process. We want companies to be successful. We want teams to be happy and to feel proud of the work that they do. And of course, all of it requires us to be able to continue to play the game, i.e. make money for the organizations that pay our salaries, or if you're not paid in money, for example, non-profit companies or organizations will be paid in other things like, you know, impacts on society or whatever, right? There's always some kind of outcome that we're looking for. And those outcomes are what matter. Principles are not any better than process. Yes, they are distilling a lot of ideas that are in the process, but they will just drive us to more process. That's not what we want. We want a very clear definition of what the goal is. Let me just give you an analogy. Most companies today are like this. Imagine you're going to play basketball. Both of you guys are in the same team, right? You get to the court, and you get to the court, and you find out that nobody's using the same uniform. Everybody's using a random uniform. You go like, how the hell do I know who's on my team? And then you have another problem, is that the lines that should be on the ground, they're not there. So you don't know what the bounds are. So how the hell do you play the game? The baskets have been taken away, so you can't shoot. There's no way to know whether you're, you know, achieving your score, because there's no way to score. And then the referee's gone. And you go like, so how do we win this game? And that's what most teams feel like today. When I go into the teams and I start seeing, you know, half allocation to one project, 20% allocation to another project, that's everybody wearing a random uniform, right? Jeff goes to Jeff and Jeff says, hey, Jeff, I need your help. This is very confusing because you both are.
Yes.
And Jeff answers to Jeff, yeah, sorry, but today is my 20% on that other project, so I can't help you, right? Imagine you passing the ball to a colleague in a basketball court, and he suddenly is now playing for the opposing team. And you go like, what the hell just happened, right? And that's what most teams feel like today. So when I go into a team, there's two things I make sure I have before I accept the gig. And that is, I want to have one goal. And the goal needs to be measuring business outcomes. No story points, no quality metrics, nothing. Business outcomes. It's either, you know, profit, user acquisition, churn, retention, whatever that is, business outcomes. And the other team, I want one team. I want one team, one goal. And this I learned from trying to do it through the process, right? I tried to implement process in many teams that weren't teams that had no goals, and I saw it fail. And one could argue, well, you didn't understand the principles. Well, that's very likely. I tend to shy away from understanding the principles because I prefer to focus on practical, right? Practical things, how things work in practice. So I don't think about principles when I'm doing the work. I'm saying, you know, is John collaborating with Mary? If they're not collaborating, who the hell cares about principles? Let's figure out what's going on, right? And what I found out is that when the team is fully dedicated to one goal, they know how to collaborate without me trying to tell them how to collaborate. I don't need to lecture them about principles. They know what to do, right? So that's what I learned. And that's why in the product owner role specifically, I talk about goals. I want a product owner that helps the team define sprint goals. No backlog, no sprint backlog, no product backlog, just goals, right? And I know that a team that is fully dedicated to a product and has a very clear goal, which they can easily measure throughout the process, and at the end, they'll figure out how to get there, which is, you know, if you think about it, the original idea of Scrum.
Yeah. I like that. I do think principles are helpful. Are they the only thing? No. And if you just have them, are they, you know, good enough by themselves to sustain a team and give them that guidance of where their guardrails are, where those out of bounds lines are? Probably not. But they do give you, I think, at least focus. If you, as long as you have a limited number of them. So like what I see in a lot of organizations, you come in and you know, their values, their principles, they're pages long, right? And like you could tie anything to them. Well, that's not really helpful. But if I do say that, like, you know, one of our core principles in how we do business is customer delight. If anything else, it's going to be customer delight and customer convenience. And that's our strategy, right? Going forward. Then I know when I'm building my product, I'm not going to build something that's very taxing on a user, even if it's really profitable, right? Like I need to live towards like, what is our differentiator as a company and like what makes us a little different. And I think that gives people alignment, at least of a little bit on the direction they should take. And then those goals and those measurable goals that you're talking about, like, are essential. Like, you have to have that. So teams know where they're going and what the goal is, and so they can write hypothesis around it, and they're really smart and they can figure this stuff out. Like, you hire really smart people, let them solve problems. We want problem solving teams. I think like cross-functional, multi-skilled, whatever you call it, people have abused that and said, well, I've got people that code and people that test on a team. That's a cross-functional team, but that team that hands off to a team that does Salesforce, a team that does something else, and a team that does something else before it actually gets out the door. And that's where the problem lies, is that there's all these delays within the organization. So I think where you were going with that, where like we need to have a team focused on delivering something concept to cash that's business value focused, is an essential part that many, many organizations forget about or don't have.
Yeah, and when you go back to principles, I mean, one could argue that one team, one goal are two principles or one principle that has two requirements, right? One could argue that. But I also want to emphasize that the point is not to be able to create a better process. And that's how principles are very often used, or in my perspective, misused. I think that the principles, if we have them, should be about what does it mean to be successful in this business? And because of that, it has to be business-centric. It has to be customer experience-centric. It has to have an understanding of what kind of industry we are in. Nonprofit needs to have different ways of delivering value to customers than for-profit companies, right? So that's what I mean. It's like we need to go back to what was the original idea of Agile, which was, let's forget about these heavy processes. Let's create a lightweight methodology that allows us to deliver value to our customers.
Yeah, I like to always go back to, I've talked to some people that were, you know, there in Snowbird when they came out with the Agile Manifesto, and they have talked about the words they were talking about when they were saying, hey, these lightweight processes we're creating, what should we call this thing? This is before they had the word Agile, and they're like, well, responsive, adaptive, agile, like those were the three words they were thinking of. And so if you think of synonyms of, you know, agile, that's what you should be thinking of. I think agile, a lot of times people think, they think fast or speed, right? They don't think like being responsive to change. They don't think being flexible to a market, right? Like that's the competitive advantage that you're supposed to be getting. And so if you create these, you know, cumbersome processes, how flexible are you? How are you able to respond to change, and how adaptive are you? You're really not, right? So I'm totally on board with, you don't want these processes that don't change, and you don't want somebody dictating that to the teams. Like the teams should create whatever process they think they need and then be flexible to change it and pull from a toolbox whenever they need to.
And have a good framework to know if they are being successful. Just an example you've already referred to. If my team hands over to a team that hands over to a team that hands over to a team, you know, four link chains are not uncommon in the software industry. So how do I know, am I successful? Of course, then you end up with what I call a goal displacement metrics, more story points. Right? More predictability. Like, who cares about how many story points you deliver if you're not delivering value to your customers? You're going to go bankrupt with higher quality? Like, how is that going to help anyone? Right? The customers also stop having your product if you go bankrupt. Right? So, like, that's the thinking. And of course, if you want to be successful in business, there are certain things that, you know, they don't guarantee, but they increase your chances of being successful in the business. And of course, responding to change is going to be one of those, right? Because there's no amount of planning that can predict the future. It helps, of course, it gets you ready. It helps you do risk management and all of that, but it's not going to guarantee. So you need to respond to change, right? That's just one of the many things we talk about in the Agile community. That's really what I want to talk about. When I talk about product ownership today to the people that I train and to the clients that I work with, I talk about, I want your product owner to have a business metric as their responsibility, not a product, not a competitive comparison sheet or a matrix. I want business metrics, like, you know, customers acquired, profit per customer, number of support calls, which is a cost associated with product development, or churn. All of those things, those matter, right? And of course, those come from the company's strategy. So we are now linking the product owner's goal and focus to the company's strategy. That's a much more productive way to think about it than to think about, hey, product owner, from now on, I want you to keep a product backlog of all of the things that come up in our many meetings, including strategy, that might be useful in the product, right? And then you end up with this, mammoth product backlogs with hundreds or thousands of items. In conferences, I jokingly ask people, what was the oldest item you removed from a backlog? And I've got as old as 7 years.
Yeah,
how
that's
about
old.
That for responding to change?
You're never doing that, right? Right? You're never doing that thing that's 7 years old. Just delete it. Like, it's never happening if it's that old, right? That's awesome. That's interesting. You often get the... So you're a big advocate for no estimates, right? You're one of the people that kind of came up with this whole idea a number of years ago. And so that's where you're kind of diving into. And, you know, but when I hear people talk about no estimates, I think there's a lot of misunderstandings out there. Oftentimes they say, well, so what? We're not going to do any kind of planning. And what you just described, there's all kinds of planning. You definitely have planning at the company level. And then you have companies, you know, vision, company strategy. Then you're saying, okay, now we got a product vision, product strategy. We got to tie that into what we're actually going to do. And now we've got like our product, you know, backlog. What does that translate as into metrics or outcomes or hypothesis that we want to do? And then like, and then we got to figure out what we're actually going to do. And then we got our sprint plan, right? So like, how do we tactically take that and plan that out? So like, there's so much planning going on. We just are trying to get rid of all the waste, right? I know you're a big lean guy. So like, we're just getting rid of the non-value added steps.
Yeah. So the thing with lean, the story with lean, of course, is that, you know, Toyota was happily doing whatever they were doing for many years until the MIT, I don't know, automotive group or whatever it was called, sent a bunch of researchers to Japan to figure out what the hell Toyota was doing that was so successful. They came back to America and they wrote a book, The Machine That Changed the World. And that book describes those practices we now call lean. And that book coined, well, it wasn't only that book, there was another article, but that book made the word lean very popular, first in the automotive industry and then manufacturing, and then later on it went to all kinds of other industries. Lean is only lean because of retrospective, right? We went and we investigated what they were already doing and then we gave it a name. Lean wasn't lean. Lean still today in Japan is called Toyota Production System. What they call the different techniques has evolved over time. They have many techniques that literally took decades to develop, right? So no estimates is just one of those ideas that has taken decades to develop. I wrote my first blog post and hosted the first talk publicly about it in 2012. So that's almost 10 years ago. And others have been talking about it. I have been practicing it since 2008. I just wasn't writing about it publicly. And the idea is that it's just a way for us to learn what works and what doesn't work and then share it with others. We give it a name. But no estimates is really about two things. I want to be very clear about what no estimates is. No estimates is not about estimation. In fact, as the name says, it is about not needing estimation, right? So the two key ideas is, as estimation is not necessary, especially if you're on the path to continuous delivery, right? We can now plan without having the step of estimation. And how does that get done, right? So very simple thing is slicing. Slicing is one of the techniques we talk about all the time in No Estimates. The idea is we do small increments, we release it to the market, we get feedback from the market, we learn, we do another small increment, right? That's the whole idea. When you get to that level of planning, which is continuous, never-ending planning, you don't need big upfront planning. Literally, you don't need it. Therefore, you don't need the estimates. Investment changes. If you do that kind of planning, investment is now a, let's call it a budgeting, right? You have this amount of people and this amount of time to spend on a product until it either proves successful or not, right? And you keep on spending that money if you see good signs and you stop spending or reduce spending if you see bad signs, right? It's continuous planning. It's a much more responsive, adaptive, agile way of planning. And it also doesn't need any estimates. Like there's no need for us to talk about estimates. Now, some people will be, you know, sticklers for detail and will say, well, you know, but the team says that they can do this in one day or one week, whatever that is. So that's an estimate. Like who cares, right? I'm not creating a Gantt chart. I'm not making a budget based on what you thought something was going to take months down the line. That's a totally different problem. So that's principle number one. Estimation is not necessary. Therefore, we do planning in completely different ways and we do it continuously. And the second, which is related to that, and it's really an outcome of continuous planning, is that no estimates is about continuous decision making, because that's what ensures project success. Delivery, successful delivery of a product is a result of many decisions made all the time, every single day, many times a day, throughout the lifetime of the project or the product. It is not a result of better planning. It is a result of better continuous decision making. So continuous planning, which does not require estimates because small increments, and continuous decision making, which of course is independent of the estimate. Every time you make a decision that changes the plan, the estimate is now obsolete. What you're going to do? Get the whole team into a room and estimate again? That would be nonsense. That would be crazy, right? Dear product owners, if you have a big backlog that has been fully estimated, what do you do when you find out that a big chunk of the product is no longer needed? Or what most commonly happens when somebody comes up with a great idea that changes a big chunk of the product? Are you going to, every time something changes in the backlog, sit down everybody and estimate all the new things and re-estimate all the things that were changed? For example, technology changes, architecture changes, team changes. You have different people now working on those ideas. That would be lunacy, but that's what is done today, because we do what I call in the book estimate-driven development. And that's what I say we don't need anymore. So continuous planning, continuous decision making, which, I mean, let's translate this to English. It's agile turned all the way up to 11, just like extreme programming was for technical practices. Spinal Tap all over again, right? The guys knew what they were talking about.
I like where you went with all that. And what was going on in my head was kind of the same question. Like, so taking a step back, you had, sorry, I got a cough. Just getting over a cold here. You were saying back a few minutes ago, you know, when Ken and Jeff originally thought of their product owner, it was the entrepreneur, it was the owner of this company. And somewhere we lost that mindset, and we put the product owner in this bureaucratic nightmare of just running the backlog, and we took away financial responsibility from that person. But exactly to what you were saying was, if you were the product owner and this was literally your money, would every time we change direction, do we want to put the team in a room and spend the time and dollars to have them re-estimate this? Like, no, of course you wouldn't want to do that because it's your money and it's waste. But when you remove that financial responsibility from them, because they're just product owners, they're just the backlog managers. Well, okay, they probably don't see it through that way. They don't see it as waste. It's okay, well, the organization wants us to go and re-estimate all of this stuff all the time because that's what they're always asking for. But I think even just that subtlety of again giving them that empowerment and that ownership of the financials again, I think that's even just one step to reinforce this idea of you don't need to do all of this stuff that you think you need to do in order to keep moving forward with the product development.
Yeah, I think the lack of even, not even financial responsibility, but financial transparency for product owners is just crazy out in the market. Like, there's so many product owners that have no idea what their P&L looks like for their product, and they don't even have a
numbers, right?
Yeah, nothing. They have no data behind what they're doing. So how do you validate that? Everything you're prioritizing and putting in your product backlog, that's assumed value that you think you're going to get. When do you actually realize that realized value? And do you even know if you're realizing it? Otherwise, you're just throwing a bunch of things on the wall and hoping something sticks, right? Like, I think what you're talking about before, I often describe it as switching from an analysis mindset to a feedback mindset. So by going and cranking everything up to 11, where you're doing a little bit of everything all the time, that's more saying we don't know everything and we're okay with that, and predictability isn't going to happen, but we're just going to do a little bit of everything. We're going to sense and respond as we learn, and we're taking more of an empirical process, right? So like, though, it's actually living those values and cranking that all the way up to 11 and just accepting we can't plan everything into the future.
We have talked about this in the past, but I feel like Jeff and I have, in Vasco, even you in this, I shouldn't say even you as well in this situation, but like being a consultant, I feel like almost teaches you that from the beginning. Because if a customer can literally fire you because you're not providing value to them, that is going to set you up for this value outcome, not dependency is not the right relationship that you've got with your customer, right? But so much of the workforce today is just full-time employment where you're going and now you expect a paycheck every 2 weeks, regardless of what you have to do. But if the business could simply fire you, and I'm not saying like from a vicious, we're working you to the bone, death marches or anything like that. But if you just had the mindset of, gee, I really just need to do whatever needs to get done in order to provide value to the organization and thus a customer, then it doesn't really matter all of this bureaucracy and process that you've been talking about, or even my specialty. It's I just should jump in and help with whatever it is going to provide the most value to a customer. So if you've never been a consultant, like maybe even just having that mindset, we've used the phrase like with a team, Okay, product owner, scrum master, development team member, pretend you up and quit. You moved across the street and you set up shop. You're going to do the exact same thing now, but you are now doing it to provide to an outside customer. How would you measure success in that? Like, would your customer, the greater organization in this situation, would they be happy with their product? Would they be happy with the level of service they're getting from you, the response time for the requests that are coming to your team? Or would they fire you because they now could, because you're not internal, and go with somebody else, a competitor in your marketplace? So again, just that simple mindset of, wow, I can be fired and I can provide value.
And as you say it that way, some people might understand, well, that's such a cruel world, right? You can just hire and fire people at will. And I'm reminded of actually when the world was not so cruel. Like if you go back to the Middle Ages, the feudal system, which is not a system I would like to go back to. I'm not arguing for that. But in the feudal system, everybody had to provide for themselves, right? There was no safety net. There was no healthcare. Like you couldn't get Medicaid or, you know, socialized healthcare or even private healthcare. You either survived or you didn't. You had to take care of yourself. Through that, you develop techniques to be able to take care of yourself, to find your sustainable pace, which some didn't, you know, granted, some didn't, but those that did thrived and survived and, you know, grew, had a big family to help out in the fields, whatever, they found mm-hmm. a technology or an approach that would guarantee their survival. Those people are real heroes. They were heroes for their families. They were heroes for the people that came after them. And that's what entrepreneurs are today. And the vast majority of entrepreneurs are just like the farmers of the feudal system. They never get talked about. They go bankrupt, right? They work themselves to the bone, as you said, and then they lose the money and then they go back to finding a job. Like that's life, right? We don't talk about that, but that has a value. Those are real heroes in today's society because they are exploring the areas that can generate a lot of value. Right? Mm-hmm. If an entrepreneur creates a product everybody loves, everybody will love the product, will benefit from the product, but you don't talk about the nights the entrepreneur didn't sleep, the times they didn't attend their kid's birthday, they missed the school party, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not easy to be an entrepreneur. I'm not saying that everybody should be an entrepreneur. That's not what I'm saying. But I do want to publicly recognize that that has a very important role for the advancement of society, and in our case, for the advancement of our companies and our industry. We need people with entrepreneurial spirit, and we need to stop hitting them in the head with the process. Give them responsibility, give them the boundaries. We all need boundaries. Everybody needs boundaries. But then let them do the work. And in product owners and teams, what this means in practice is that don't burden them with the need to have a never-ending backlog. Just ask them every 2 weeks, what did you deliver that made the product better? And if they don't have an answer, sorry guys, like if you can't come up with a good thing for us and for the customer, either we change direction or we change people. That's just how it goes. We live and die by the choices we make as businesses. That means either we help the customer or we lose the customer. And that's something I tell all my product owner students in the workshops that I give. There's only one question a customer has in their mind every time they interact with you and your product, which is, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah.
That's the question everybody should be asking themselves. All product owners, all product teams out there should be asking themselves that question. What have we done for our customers lately?
Yep. I often, because you see a lot of teams where it's like, well, I just do my specialty and I produce this output and it doesn't provide value because then it just sits like, out there and waits for somebody else to pick it up. And one of the questions, powerful questions, a good tool for Scrum Masters out there is ask your teams, if you didn't deliver something to production by whatever time period that the business wants, if you didn't get a paycheck, if you didn't deliver something, how would you work? So if your paycheck depended on it, what would you do differently? And they're like, well, we wouldn't work the way we're working. Well, then don't do that. Do what you would do if your paycheck depended on it. Like, just like you were talking about before, like the farmers, like, hey, like if we don't produce something, we're not going to be able to eat. Like there's just no food. Like that's the way it works. And so everybody has to contribute and everybody has to help produce something. Chad Beyer, who's one of our good friends, he used to work on a dairy farm and he grew up on a dairy farm. And he always talks about dairy farms being the family farm. It's a big thing in Wisconsin, like the original cross-functional team. Like everybody contributes. Everybody has to work together. Everybody has a part, no matter if you're five or if you're, you know, 18 or if you're, you know, 40, like everyone's doing something, you know, to contribute. And I think you have to think about that as a team too. Like you need to change your mindset. It's not about just being really efficient at a certain task. That's not the goal.
And the a question, you know, going from there is, when was the last time you felt proud of being part of that team and delivering that product? Because if proud is a very good early sign, if you stop feeling pride in the work that you're doing, something is off. There are many things that could be off. There's not only one answer to that question, but something is off, and use that as a resource, right? And also product owners out there, if you feel that you're spending way too much time looking at a spreadsheet or Jira, ask yourself, what's off? Something is off, because I should be talking about vision, goals, impact on the business, benefit for the customer. I should not be having endless discussions about the priority of feature 127 versus feature 135.
Okay, cool. So let's wrap this up with, or try to wrap everything around business agility. So when I think of business agility, I think of everything that you need to deliver the business value or the results you were talking about before, Vasco. So it might be that legal team that needs to review something. It might be a marketing team that needs something. And you need to think about the holistic value stream of what it needs to do, what you need to deliver on. And then I need to start thinking about, like, as an organization, as the priorities change, as I learn new things about my customers and where the market's going, how adaptable is my organization to change whatever structure we need to adapt to solving that problem? And so if I see a team, like I was working with a team once where some new thing came up, some vendors that was doing this big process for them stopped. And then they're like, we need to figure out how to solve this problem. Or like, basically, we're not going to be able to collect revenue. Like, it's a big problem. And they had no plan for it, whatever. And they were able to, I mean, this was, they were just getting going on their agile journey. And they were able to spin up a team, fully cross-functional, everything they needed to do it within, I think it was like 3 weeks, which isn't bad, because that would have normally taken them about 6 months, you know, in the past. But could you do it even faster? Like, could you do that in a couple of days? Could you just be like, yeah, we got this. And then you just take it and deliver it, start working on it to deliver it. I think that's a good measure of business agility. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so for that's definitely a good measure and a good story too about business agility. I think that at the end of the game, at the end of the day, business is a game that we want to play indefinitely, right? It's not, you don't play the business game to reach a goal. You play the business game to continue to play the business game, right? I like this. I think it's in The Living Company where D. Hawk talks about business as being life. Right? Business is life. Business is not different from life. Just like we talk about work-life fusion, it's also business-life fusion. You want to be proud of the business you're part of. You want to be proud of what you give your customers. And when it comes to adaptability, if it is your life, you're going to be adaptable. And herein lies one of the things we talked about as, for me, the biggest risk of any process framework is to transform and change the goal from helping the customer and helping ourselves to follow the process, right? And sometimes you follow the process and you also help the customer and you also help yourself, but you're not measuring it. It just happens by accident, which, you know, many businesses are successful by accident, so nothing wrong with that. But it's not what you can be proud of, because, you know, who's proud of delivering one more story than last sprint? I mean, some people are, but most people will say, like, I don't know.
Right? Yeah, whose life did I impact, right? Like, yeah, or what difference did it make in the world?
Once a team came to me and said, we're fed up with doing these pixel pushing tasks. Can we do something that matters? And that was a great moment, because that was a resource we could use. And together with the product owner, we came up with a goal. We stopped using backlogs. We only had a goal and we did something amazing that generated revenue, was a very successful project for that company. And all came from that need that the team expressed, and they felt safe to do that, that, you know, we're tired of doing this minute tasks of pixel pushing. Can we do something that matters? And I think that's what we are all looking for. And that's how you become a business that is able to be agile, to be responsive, to be adaptable, is that you measure what your impact is in your customers. You measure the impact of your actions in the success of the business. You don't measure, you know, am I doing Scrum or Kanban? Whichever, just take one, right? Just follow something. Use process as a convention to facilitate collaboration. Don't use it as the goal. The process should never be the goal. It should be a process is a tool, right? It's a tool you use in the right context and you throw away when you don't need it, right? So for me, business agility really is the core of what business was all about, right? Think about mom and pop shops, right? They have to adapt. You know, I remember the electronic shops of yesteryear when I was a kid, and they sold this, you know, ZX Spectrum, the Amiga computer, and they had all of these cassettes with games, and then later on the floppy disks with games, and that's what they would sell because that's what people would buy. And then later on, many of those companies started selling, you know, CD players. First was the Walkman, then the Discman, the CD player that you could bring with you when you went running. Who remembers those? Can you even imagine running with a CD player? Well, some people did. Then they started selling PCs, which were a new thing back when I was a kid, right? Not everybody had a PC. PC was like a big quote-unquote computer. And then they adapted, and some of those became software development consultancy companies. Because, you know, the guys who started that, they were just so much into computers that they took any chance to continue to work on with computers. And eventually they figured out, hey, I can sell my programming skills. And they started doing that. There's a couple of shops like that in my hometown that still exist today and still do custom software for all kinds of industries. The industries have changed. They used to do that for textile factories. Now they do that for hospitals and universities because that's the industry that is growing in that city, right? That's what the whole business is all about. Like this idea that business is static and we execute on a five-year plan. Like we're not in Soviet Russia anymore. Like five-year plans, come on, guys. Business is about serving the community. It is about delivering value to the community. That is, of course, measured in terms of, you know, income, revenue, because if they don't like you, they're not going to give you the money, right? So that's for me, that's the core of actually being in business. It is to be adaptable. It is to be responsive. It is to continuously thrive to deliver value to our customers. So if you ask me, what's the measure of business agility? I would say, I don't care how you measure business agility. I care. Do your customers like the products you provide? If you do that with Waterfall, more power to you. It's not going to last long. Take it while it lasts. Especially in software, you're probably running out of business if you're not doing continuous delivery, incremental improvements to your product all the time. Hello, Tesla. Hello, car manufacturers, right? So the point is that for me, when we talk about business agility, there are many things we should talk about. There are many details, many processes we can talk about. But at the end of the day, it is about having a positive impact in the society we are part of, therefore adapting to the society's needs. And I want to say one thing that is very dear and close to my heart, which is that software has become so important in society today that us software people have a responsibility to our fellow human beings to improve the industry so that we don't, for example, close schools to pay for government software projects. Stop paying nurses and doctors to pay for a healthcare software record management system like we're doing in Finland, which is a disgrace. We're going to pay $2.5 billion for a software project, which is basically a glorified database with a UI. That's a couple crazy. Of guys in a shed could do that in a couple of weeks. And we're paying $2.5 billion to a company, which is even a private company. They don't publish any of their financials. It's all secretive. I have to say, software people, the future of the world is in your hands. You have to take responsibility. And if you ask me, taking responsibility is about not allowing anymore the concept of working in big bang, upfront planning, waterfall style software development. It is about being responsive to the customers more than anything. And then, of course, also to the needs of the business, because businesses need to exist and they have their own structures that we need to improve. But, you know, we need to respect what's there and work with it and improve from that. So that for me is the most important thing. And that's why I get so riled up about the whole idea of even having a backlog. Like, what do I care? Is my customer buying my product? Are they returning? for the services that we offer. Are they giving us good reviews? Are they recommending the product to their customers? That's a much better measure. So business agility is about constant validation that our business is providing value to society. And when it isn't, change it so that it does. That's for me what business agility is all about. And this is why I'm 100% convinced that no estimates will become the approach people take in the future. Because, I mean, let's be honest, estimates are a new thing. Project management is only about 100 years old. We never did this like this, right? We build castles incrementally. I am from Portugal, which is more than 1,000-year-old country. We had a lot of war, so we build a lot of castles. All of the castles were built incrementally. Nobody went to the king and said, hey, we'll build this magnificent castle. That happened later on. But when we started, when we had to survive, everything was incremental. You go to airports today. You guys travel. I travel. You see airports being refactored all the time while being in use. So if we can refactor airports, why can't we refactor software? It's a hell of a lot easier if you ask me, right?
Yep.
So
yeah, I really like what you're saying there about business agility. One of the big takeaways from when you kind of started the conversation was that it's not a defined end. There's an infinite gain. Simon Sinek has a new book, The Infinite Game, but you're talking about life. You're talking about business. You're talking about a product. Like, you know, parts of your product live and die, right? But like eventually, like you're talking about those people, those small companies, you know, they started with electronics and whatever, you know, peripherals were out there into now doing, you know, custom software development. That company lives on forever or can, and that you just need to adapt to whatever's around you. And I think that's the important part about business agility is that there's no end. I think a lot of companies come in and they say, we want this agile transformation. And they think of it like there's an end to it. And there's no end. It's a continual journey. It's like the new way of living. It's a different mindset of how you work. So it's very different than I think what a lot of people might perceive switching to more of an agile approach.
So Vasco, what do you want to plug here?
So everybody should go and listen to the ScrumMasterToolbox.org. Podcast. That's a daily podcast with about 10-15 minute snippets every day that focus on actionable advice from people who do the actual work. And the reason why I tell people to listen to the podcast is, of course, I do the podcast, so you know I'm rightly proud of the work that I do, but also because it's real people like Jeff and myself who do the work every day and share their stories. It's real life stories. It's not theorizing. It's not building big frameworks. It's about agility where it matters, which is day-to-day life, day-to-day work life that these people live through. And I mean, every day that I interview people, I learn something new. I've been doing this for 5 years and I still learn every time I interview people. And I think that the people who are in this industry are an amazing resource for all of us to learn from. We have right now 260 weeks of content live, plus the bonus episodes. That's the largest Scrum audio library in the world. There's nothing bigger than that. You could start listening today, listen to one a day, and you would be done 5 years from now. That's how much content there is. Of course, the site has a search. You can find whatever topics you're interested in. There's also tagging so that you can look at, for example, you want new retrospectives, just listen to the retrospective episodes, right? But the reason why I started that podcast is exactly to bring out the experience that is already there and that people can fill their toolbox with the experience of others. You don't need to do all the mistakes everybody has made. You can learn from their experience. So go to the website, check out the topic that you care about. It's all free and available out there. It's forever free, so it's never going to be charged to listen to the podcast. Listen to every day when going to work or whatever. Pick a topic and go there and listen about it. So scrummastertoolbox.org.
You can reach out or listen to Jeff and I talk more to different guests on the Agile Wire. Available on iTunes, Google Play, Apple Play Store. And you can also find our courses at scrum.org. So Jeff and I do a lot of public courses out there in the community. We talk with product owners, scrum masters, development teams, holistic teams, leaders, We do different courses on using Scrum and Kanban together, like how can you combine these two amazing practices. So we do courses on UX, combining UX with the development team and really creating these problem-solving teams. So look us up, scrum.org. We've got lots of public courses coming out, and we'd be happy to have a conversation if anybody has any questions about those.
Awesome. All right, gentlemen.
Thank you for listening to the Agile Wire. We are consistently inspecting and adapting ourselves. We would appreciate feedback at feedback@theagilewire.com or on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play Store. See you next time.